One of the principal purposes of this course is to familiarize ourselves with official church teaching as expressed in magisterial documents, official documents published through Roman congregations or by the popes. There is a tendency in our world today, and unfortunately also within our church, to imagine that issues which are being raised in a particularly powerful and expressive way in popular media must be new issues that have not been properly considered in the past, and thus there's a tendency to wait for the institution to make new pronouncements, or as a part of this, to imagine that this issue has never been effectively dealt with. As we'll see, there are some foundational documents that actually have anticipated in a rather incredible way precisely the debates and precisely the unfortunate directions in which we find ourselves moving together as a society. And one of these is the Declaration on Procured Abortion, which was published in 1974. Now, the Church has reiterated and restated and reformulated the teaching that one finds here, but not in any significant way altered it. One finds it cited over and over again in later documents, particularly in the Catechism of the Church and in some of the bioethical documents that we've already looked at, albeit rather briefly, and to which we will return again. This is one of the foundational documents that we need to be aware of, that we need to be able to return to, because again, this is exactly what the Church does in attempting to clarify the teaching on abortion and on life at its most vulnerable. As we will see toward the end of this document, and this is something that we will highlight toward the end of this section on abortion, the notions of conscience and its significance, as well as heroism, are particularly stressed. Conscience understood in the Catholic context as a reflection of the divine light, as a place within us where we are actually able to be aware of what is right and wrong, because we were created by God, we reflect God's image, and because we choose to remain in communion with, in communication with God. The whole notion of natural law, which we've discussed at the beginning of this course, is related to the idea of conscience, and it is the reflection within us of the divine law, of an awareness of what is right. So Catholics believe that there is a human consciousness that can be tapped into, an awareness on the part of each individual of fundamental rights and wrongs, which, although overlaid by habits, often habits of sin, and the directions in which one pulls society, can nevertheless be uncovered, with the exception perhaps of extremely pathological cases, situations such as psychopathy, where the individual's conscience has been so completely benumbed that they're unable to be aware of this. The issues of conscience and of heroism will be particularly highlighted in this document, and as we'll see, the tragedy of our culture is that we are now taking precisely those words, conscience and heroism, and using them to mean exactly the opposite of what the Church, Western society, and most of our cultures have always understood them to mean. We find ourselves in the astonishing and extremely difficult circumstance of using a vocabulary that is used in exactly the opposite way by the world in which we live. So let's turn to this text and see what we can find within it. In number one, article one, in section one, the introduction, there is a rather beautiful description of the current, it's described here as a sort of an astonishing paradox in which one has at the same time an increase, as they put it, of unqualified protests against the death penalty and every form of war, and at the same time, and often by the same individuals, the vindication of the liberalization of abortion, either in its entirety or in ever broader indications. So it's one of the strange paradoxes of our society that on the one hand, there is an exercise of compassion in which one specifically focuses on the wrongness of the death penalty and the terrible horror of war on the one hand, and yet individuals who clamor for these realities can at the same time seek liberalization of abortion laws, that is to say, seek for this, the destruction of the life of the unborn and the most vulnerable. Now, of course, that is precisely done by individuals who are unwilling to admit that abortion is the taking of the life of someone who is vulnerable. And so it's in light of this that one finds toward the end of that first paragraph the statement that the church is conscious of the fact that it belongs to her vocation to not to remain silent on such a topic. And I'd like us to focus on number two, because it contains, in a very succinct way, the fundamental difficulties with which we find ourselves struggling right now as a nation in regard to the issues connected with abortion and with regulation of restriction of conscience in regard to physicians and healthcare professionals that would like to object to being forced to engage in various kinds of actions. Let's look at number two. In many countries, the public authorities that resist the liberalization of abortion laws are the object of powerful pressures aimed at leading them to this goal. So this was written in the early 1970s. Powerful pressures seeking to force governments to liberalize abortion laws. The statements on the part of those who want to encourage this liberalization claim that this would violate no one's conscience, for each individual would be left free to follow their own opinion while being prevented from imposing it on others. And so the philosophical implications, or the philosophical core of this, which is highlighted and in red type, is ethical pluralism is claimed to be a normal consequence of ideological pluralism. That is, a willingness to, and even an acknowledgement of the importance of, tolerating and acknowledging the value, the differences between and the value of differences between different forms of ideologies, such as different approaches to government, or, as we would say today, the value of multiculturalism, of acknowledging that people come from a variety of different forms of upbringing and social constraints. To acknowledge this and to try to work with this is important, but if the consequence of that kind of multiculturalism is that ethical pluralism must necessarily be tolerated, then one has stepped over and into over an important boundary and into a very dangerous area. For the reason that's given in black there is a great difference between the one and the other, for action affects the interests of others more quickly than does mere opinion. That is, mere opinion. Tolerating other people's ideas and seeking to understand them, ideological pluralism, is different from ethical pluralism, in which one acknowledges the validity and the right of individuals to act in particular ways. So, in the name of tolerance, or in the name of culturalism, the idea that many things should be permitted is an unfortunate and dangerous extension of the good notion that one has to be tolerant of and respectful of other individuals' ideas. The consequences of ethical pluralism is not the non-violation of conscience, but the setting into effect in society of events which will in fact come to shape people's conscience. It is the acknowledgement of and the moving towards a point of view in which one finally says there are no standards according to which one can judge. And in number three, and remember again, we're talking about the early and mid-70s, there has been strong resistance to this attempt to liberalize and make abortion more widespread on the part of Christian lay people, especially physicians, especially those in healthcare, but also parents' associations, statesmen, and leading figures in posts of responsibility. And the Episcopal conferences have made their own statements as well. And so the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, in number four, feels that it is its responsibility to transmit the teaching of the Magisterium on this point very clearly. And so if we move down now to section two, what we will find is a review of what we have already looked at in some detail in our historical study of the development of the Catholic bioethical position. The perspective of faith, looking at the both theological and biblical basis of acknowledging the importance of life from its very beginning, that's in number five. Then the reiteration in number six of traditional texts, which we have already looked at, the Didache in particular, and Tertullian, whom we also have considered in regard to the Church's consistent and unbroken tradition of condemning abortion. And then finally, a text which we've seen before, which is a kind of summary of the philosophical traditions that extended through the Middle Ages, and a misunderstanding of which have caused people to claim that the Church has changed its approach, and the statement here that various opinions on the infusion of the spiritual soul did not introduce doubt in regard to the illicitness of abortion, and the Church clearly acknowledges here that in the Middle Ages, where there was the opinion that the soul was not present until after the first few weeks, there was a distinction between the evaluation of sin and the gravity of penal sanctions. And again, the question of penal sanctions, that is the punishment that is to be accorded to this particular sin, was studied and reflected on, but the question of it being sinful was never held in question. The question of the taking of life at any stage in gestation. And the summary and conclusion, it was never denied that procured abortion, even during the first days, was an objectively grave fault. And the condemnation, as is noted, there was in fact a unanimous condemnation. We've already discussed this. And then there's a reflection on the nature of the Church's documents, especially the legal documents and those in canon law that have resulted in the practice which we find ourselves with today. And as we move through section 3, we can move rather quickly because this is a section we've already looked at earlier in the course, but there are a couple of points that we haven't highlighted as we probably should at this point. In number 8, respect for human life is not just a Christian obligation, it is the conviction of the Church, and this is something that is challenged in society today. Human reason is sufficient to impose on it the basis of the analysis of what a human person is and should be. So one should have the capacity in human reason, even not specifically informed by revelation, one should have the capacity to analyze and determine what a human person is and should be. The difficulty we face now is that human reason is being clouded by and even repressed by the notion that multiple values must be held as equivalent, different points of view must be regarded as equally acceptable, and therefore the notion that there could be an underlying principle such as ratio or reason that could decide which of these points of view is more likely to be true is in fact not only challenged, but it is taken for granted that there is no underlying concept, there is no standard according to which these varying points of view could be assessed and one judged as being higher than the other. So the Church is convinced that there is this quality of reason that can properly analyze what the human person is. Unfortunately, we live in a culture, and tragically also, this is sometimes true of the philosophical culture, of those who should be responsible for emphasizing reason in the academy, who are precisely those who are emphasizing the inability or even the meaninglessness, the need for deconstruction of ideas of or concepts of what constitutes fundamental human rights. And in number 9, part of the difficulty we face is that as Catholics, we are convinced that temporal life lived in this world is not identifiable with the person. That is, our life is not merely what we see in biological or temporal terms, what we can measure using the skills of science or what we can see lived out over time. There is more to the human person than what can be seen because we have an eternal destiny, a destiny of living with God. And there is a transcendent and inestimable quality of the value of each individual person. And again, a conviction that might be grudgingly assented to by secularists, it is society which is at the service of the person because the person will not fulfill their destiny except in God. Again, the first part might be grudgingly admitted, but not the second, that the person has a destiny that can only be fulfilled in relationship to God. This is something we believe, but which our culture will vigorously dispute. And number 10, moral teaching should enlighten conscience, and law should specify and organize external behavior. This is the basis on which the Church has begun to embrace and use the language of human rights. In fact, the Church contends in number 10, that there are rights which society does not grant because they precede society. The typical 18th century and then American way of describing this would speak of inalienable rights that belong to individuals. The church would say they were there long before the Enlightenment. It's just that perhaps they were articulated a little more clearly there. These are the human rights which our age boasts of having formulated, and the first of these, as we've noted before, is the right of the person to life in number 11. It doesn't belong to public authority to recognize it for some and not for others. All discrimination is evil, whether founded on race, sex, color, or religion, and one might add to that disability. The idea that one can prevent individuals from coming to life because they are afflicted with a disability is an equally evil form of discrimination. And, indeed, discrimination based on various stages of life in number 12 is also unacceptable. And we've seen with number 12, from the time the ovum is fertilized, and we won't quibble out about this at the moment, we'll discuss the question of fertilization and the process of fertilization later in the course, but from fertilization, a new life is begun, the life of a truly human being. And then we've already looked at the text of footnote number 19. Science is not competent to determine the question of the existence or the infusion of or the beginnings of a human soul, and the church does not pronounce on that question officially. And then finally, below that blue text, the highlighted text just before section 4, it's not up to the biological sciences to determine when a human person is constituted, even though there are those, of course, in the biological sciences who would imagine that they are. The trouble is, personhood is not a medical, biological, anatomical, or scientific concept. It is a philosophical construct, and indeed in theology it has multiple definitions. So often you will hear neurologists or other physicians talking about their competence to describe whether or not there is a person based on the number of functioning brain cells. And again, that does not belong to the competence of individuals in those disciplines. It is not a concept that is itself scientific or subject to scientific proof or disproof. It is a philosophical idea. And I'd like us to note, particularly in number 14, the response to various objections, that the church does not deny, but in fact acknowledges the seriousness of the reasons which the defenders of abortion often bring forward as serious problems that need to be dealt with. Notice the text that's highlighted here. In certain cases, perhaps in quite a considerable number of cases, by denying abortion, one endangers important values. They are acknowledged to be important values to which it is normal to attach great value. We do not deny these very great difficulties. And then I've artificially put in numbers 1 through 4 in the text. Number 1, reasons of health. Sometimes a question even of life or death for the mother. Number 2, the burden represented by an additional child. 3, the additional child that may actually suffer from a defect of one sort or another, be abnormal or of low intelligence. Number 4, the importance attributed to different classes of society, that one may be dishonored or lose one's social standing, one's job, for example. None of these are denied. The church does not deny that these are serious and important questions. What the church does deny is that they take precedence over the life of the innocent. That the fact that these are important and that some people judge them to be overwhelmingly important does not take away from the fact that this does not trump, that these can never be regarded as greater than the life of the innocent. And that's precisely the problem with cultural pluralism. Individuals will bring these values forward and say, well, this is important to me, therefore my concern in regard to this area is as important as your claim that innocent life has ultimate paramount value. And so the summary statement, we proclaim only that none of these reasons can ever objectively confer the right to dispose of another's life, even when that life is only beginning. And if we then drop down to Numbers 15 and 16, we'll see that other issues, which are now raised in a very strident and even triumphalistic way, are openly acknowledged. The movement for the emancipation of women, insofar as it seeks essentially to free them from all unjust discrimination, is on perfectly sound ground, is to be embraced by and accepted by the church. And especially the text adds, in the different forms of cultural background, there is a great deal to be done in this regard. There are cultures where women are held in a horrific kind of subjection. But, and this is the conclusion, one cannot change nature, nor can one exempt women any more than men from what nature demands of them. And so the church would not accept that that pregnancy is an unnatural burden, or that pregnancy can ever be defined as a disease. All publicly recognized freedom is always limited by the rights of others. So the right of a woman to her own body is not regarded as trumping, as regarded as superior to the right of an innocent to be born, to be brought into the world. So in number 16, the same thing applies to sexual freedom. The church understands sexual freedom to mean mastery progressively acquired by reason and by authentic love over instinctive impulse, without diminishing pleasure but keeping it in its proper place. This is sexual freedom, the freedom that comes from a progressive mastery. And this is the language that's used in the Catechism and in other church teaching in regard to the positive notion of sexual freedom, how to use our sexuality and not be bound by it, that is to say, determined by it. But if, on the contrary, that is to say, if what one means by sexual freedom is instead to understand that men and women are free to seek sexual pleasure to the point of satiety, satisfaction, completion, fulfillment, without taking into account any law or the essential orientation of sexual life to its fruits of fertility, then this idea has nothing Christian in it. It is even unworthy of a human being. So the church is challenging the sexual mores that are being held as not only normative, but as liberating by our society. The church's response is, this is unworthy of humanity. This will unmake something fundamental of what it means for us to be human beings. And in number 17, as we've seen, technology serves a good purpose when it serves humankind and respects the finality, that is to say, the end for which we were created. In number 18, there is an acknowledgement of the importance of making choices about the size of one's family. This, as we'll see, is understood and articulated in Humanae Vitae. It had already been spoken of in 1968. However, the right to choose and make responsible choices about the size of one's family and when one is going to have children does not mean that one has the right to make use of abortion, either as an individual or as a culture, as a society, as a nation, as a means of regulating birth. And in number 19, a section we've already looked at the very beginning of the course, the legislator who is working against abortion, but in a culture that is actively trying to promote it, who finds themselves in the very difficult circumstance of having to sign on to legislation which restricts abortion, but which therefore is an acknowledgement that abortion might be permissible. But this is different, as we've seen and as we will see in more detail, from a legislator who makes weaselly statements like, well, I think abortion is wrong, but individuals should be free to make their own choices. That's not what the church is speaking of here. This is a question of someone fundamentally and clearly committed to making changes in the law in order to restrict abortion, but who, because of the complex and messy nature of politics, may be forced to sign on to a law that restricts but does not yet forbid abortion. And this is clearly acknowledged in this document and in subsequent legislation as well, as we've already seen. So we can drop down to number 21. A human law can abstain from punishment, but it cannot declare to be right what would be opposed to the natural law. Again, this conviction that there is something fundamentally human about protection of innocent life that cannot be lost without our losing an essential quality of our humanness. and in number 22, a clear statement that physicians, nurses, no one in healthcare should find themselves obliged to cooperate closely in abortions and thus have to choose between the law of God and their professions. Something which, ironically, we've already noted, was accorded to Catholic physicians during National Socialism in Germany in the 1930s and 40s, but which is seriously questioned and is in danger of being abolished in our own country at this time. And then in conclusion, number 6, section 6, number 24, following one's conscience in obedience to the law is not always the easy way. Sometimes heroism is required. So let me reassert that the notions of conscience and heroism are held up here as essential qualities that will help us to realize why abortion is wrong. Unfortunately, the nature of our culture now is that these precise words, these exact concepts, are being used in a twisted way to suggest that conscience may encourage one to perform abortion, and it may be heroic to take the life of the innocent for some cause that is regarded as valid. And finally, in number 25, a reiteration of the fact that we make our decisions in light of the fact that we know we are being prepared for a life beyond this life. And in number 27, the Church's necessity of saying that a point of view which considers fertility as an evil cannot be allowed to spread without contradiction. And in many ways, that is precisely the problem we find ourselves struggling with today. Fertility is regarded as a problem, as a danger that has to be medicated against, and tragically, as we'll see, some of the methods of controlling or restricting fertility combined with sexual permissiveness results paradoxically and horrifyingly in infertility as a major problem that has to be coped with by medical science today. And so, in conclusion, one finds that this foundational document, which will be quoted consistently and frequently, and is frequently referred to even today, does anticipate many of the issues with which we're struggling at this time, and is well worth close reading and careful consideration.